but you're supposed to interrupt.
Good morning. I'd like to open the House Committee on Business and Labor Wednesday, or excuse me, Monday, March 23rd.
Time flies, Mr. Chair.
I'm working all weekend. I'd like to open a public hearing for House Bill 3239. Jan, could you give us a brief description, please?
I will, Mr. Chair and committee members. This measure expands the definition of the lender to include anyone selling agricultural land to a beginning farmer, an institution organized under the Federal Farm Credit Act, and any other person or entity defined by Business Oregon through administrative rule. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments before you.
Thank you. And I think we have Representative Klim to kick us off this week. And he's looking for reinforcements, but has none.
There's a lot of these. That's kind of scary.
Now, this could be telling.
Could be.
Good morning. And if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Brian Klim, a representative from District 21 here in Salem. And I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 3239. Some of you may remember the Aggie Bond Bill from 2013. Some of you won't, especially our members, colleagues who've just come this session. This bill was called House Bill 2700, and it established a program to allow for a federal tax credit for lenders who would make loans to first-time farmers and or people expanding their farm operations. What House Bill 3239 specifically does is expands the definition of who would be eligible for that tax credit as a lender. In particular, we inadvertently, in the way we describe the lender, left out the Farm Credit Services, which is one of the biggest agricultural lenders in Oregon, and we thought the definition would have covered them, but it doesn't. Their president is here today, along with their representative in the Capitol, to talk a little bit about what they do and why they would be really helpful in this program. It also allows for other people who are carrying their sale of their property on a contract, which is something I very nearly did the first when I married my wife. We were looking at expanding our orchard, and there was another grower who was kind of in retirement age, and he wanted to carry the contract. I didn't end up getting there in time, and he sold to somebody else just before we could get our act together. But these kind of transactions are not uncommon in agriculture, where the grower wants to carry the note. So the bill is fairly simple in that regard. It doesn't change the program in any other way. It just allows owner-carried notes, and then also the folks like the Farm Services who were inadvertently left, Farm Credit Services who were left out of the last bill, to be covered under the definition of lender that then would be eligible for the federal tax credit. I will note these loans don't come from the state. They come from private funds. But the state has to authorize the program for that for the lender to become eligible for the federal tax credit. With that, I would take any questions.
Any questions for Representative Klim? Just, I guess I'll ask you one. Nobody else seems to be. Under the bill, it says that other persons... a person is one of the following that can make these loans, and it says other persons or entities as defined by rule adopted by the Oregon Business Development Department. Mm-hmm. Curious where that's headed. It seems kind of broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what we're trying to do, in case we miss another one in this attempt, we were hoping to avoid having to come back again 2 years later to add another person, and instead just let OBDD do that if the situation arises where we didn't get this one right either.
And you may not know the answer to this, but are these lenders also licensed under the Department of Consumer and Business Services?
I don't know the answer to that, Mr. Chair, but I would suspect that someone, for example, a farmer selling their land under a contract wouldn't be.
Right.
Thank you.
Probably not. All right. Any other questions?
Mr.
Chair.
Representative Escobedo.
On that line, I think that haven't we gone through and had bills that if you had three or more loans per year, then you had to be required to be registered, mm-hmm. but other than that, you wouldn't be. So it would come into play as well.
Yeah, and I guess where my question was leading was, what if somebody is making more than three loans? Would they be required under this?
I think they would be required to.
Yeah. So we'll get a clarification on that later. It's not a critical piece, but it would be nice to know. Not seeing any other questions, Representative Clem. You are free to go.
Relatively easy.
Or stay.
Thank you.
Was there anybody else we got signed up? John McCauley, Brent Finsu. And let's bring up those two first.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCauley. I'm the lobbyist for Northwest Farm Credit Services, and with me is Brent Finch, who is the Oregon president for Northwest Farm Credit Services. Since this bill apparently is aimed directly at our organization, we thought it might be appropriate that we let the committee know that we do support House Bill 3239. We were disappointed to learn after the 2013 session, where we had worked with the proponents to make sure that Northwest Farm Credit Services was included. We thought the language was broad enough to make that happen, but apparently it wasn't, and so this fix is now before you. Northwest Farm Credit Services is part of the farm credit system, which is a federally regulated system. We are a producer-owned cooperative serving farmers, ranchers, fishers, foresters in the four Northwest states, but we also include Alaska. And we believe that this bill fits very nicely with the initiative that Northwest Farm Credit Services has taken to serve beginning young and small producers. It's called Ag Visions, and we are serving currently more than 300 small beginning farmers in Oregon under that program. I should also note that a similar program exists in Washington State, and Northwest Farm Credit Services participates actively in that program, and we plan to do the same in Oregon if we're allowed to with the passage of this bill.
Great. I'm going to go ahead and provide any testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brent Fetch, Oregon President for Northwest Farm Credit Services. Northwest Farm Credit Services has a program called Ag Vision. That's just the label we put on our young, beginning, and small producer program. The reason I'm here today is that this bill, the Aggie Bonds program, provides yet another arrow in the quiver, if you will, in partnering with Oregon, USDA, private parties, as was mentioned in the previous testimony, to help beginning farmers get started. I believe the committee and the chair is well aware of the capital-intensive nature of farming today. It's a barrier to entry, and working together, I think that we can expand on the success that we've had in Washington. We can expand on the success we've had with Ag Vision to make sure we've got farmers tomorrow. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming in and supporting this bill, because I know how important it is in a pretty bit large agricultural community and a lot of family that is either forestry or farmed, so both sides. Just wondering if you could give us a brief overview of how you see this working with your program and how you utilize it, because I know a lot of young farmers right now that are, you know, 30 years old or 25 years old that are wanting to get into it, that have been through FFA, lots of different programs like that, and just haven't had the financial means to get involved, and how this could help, because there's a lot of farmers that are wanting to retire that don't have family members who want to be involved, and they're looking for someone they can hand their farms over to or start working with to sell their farms to. So maybe if you could give the committee just a little background on how you see this working with your company.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Weiner. As far as how this bill and the program will help us, as I mentioned before, I just think it's important. You need a variety of tools to make this work. The tax exemption adds just a little bit of yield. I'll speak plainly. Oftentimes, these loans have higher risk profile than what a financial services company would pursue. And by adding in that tax exemption, it helps overcome the yield that you would normally require. So the short answer, sir, is that it allows us to extend credit more cost-effectively from the farmer's point of view. Our Ag Vision program, which I mentioned previously, our board has already authorized to provide lower rates and waive fees, as one small step to help with the affordability of that credit. Again, we also use other partners such as Farm Service Agency loan guarantees. When you think about it, if Northwest Farm Credit or some other lender in the state of Oregon can come together with the funds, take advantage of the Aggie Bond tax exemption to enhance yield a little bit relative to the risk profile, and perhaps work with Farm Service Agency on a loan guarantee, then the total package becomes something not only bankable in the financial services point of view, but also provides the much-needed help to the beginning farmer to get started.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for being here on a Monday morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Started. Up next, Kristen Johnson and Ivan Maluski.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Kristen Johnson from the Oregon State Treasury. I'm just here to express Treasury's support of the bill and to answer any questions. The Debt Management Department has been working with DOJ and ABDD on this, getting the program started, and we're supportive of the change.
Thank you.
All right. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Maluski with Friends of Family Farmers. I'd like to thank you for holding a hearing on the bill today. I'd like to thank Representative Clem and Farm Credit Services and Treasury for coming in and giving it some extra context. Just a quick reminder, this is actually a slight fix to a bill that was passed in 2013 by the Oregon Legislature, House Bill 2700. So the actual beginning and expanding farmer loan program has already been created. Business Oregon has finalized its rules for participation, but one thing that we discovered during the process was that the definition of qualifying lender was not as broad as we had thought it was when we passed the 2013 bill. So that's specifically why you see the inclusion of farm credit services and entities organized under the Farm Credit the Farm Credit Administration being included here to ensure, because they are one of the most prolific lenders to small and beginning farmers in the region, and they're during the rulemaking process, they also expressed quite a deal of interest in being involved in this program. So, in part, we're trying to make sure that they're back into the program as we thought they were originally in 2013. The second piece is to expand the definition to include owner-financed agreements where there's a farm owner selling directly to or agreeing to carry the loan for the potential borrower. Business Oregon is still administering the rules, making sure that we're not, issuing bonds for faulty deals. But and ultimately, we just felt that it was important to have this sort of aspect, expand the pool of potential lenders under this program. So without belaboring it, the issue here ultimately is that it's very challenging for beginning farmers to get involved in agriculture today. Interest rates are high. Capital is not being issued very easily. The average age of Oregon farmers is approximately 60 years old right now. The Oregon Department of Agriculture estimates that somewhere between 25% to 50% of agricultural land is going to change hands in coming decades. So this is one of a pool of programs. Again, it was mentioned that there are some federal programs that the Farm Service Agency manages. Ultimately, what's happening here is we're allowing Oregon beginning farmers who meet the IRS definition of first-time farmer to tap into this this program. It's in place in many other states. We have it here in Oregon. So again, we're just trying to make sure the definition of lender is broad enough to reach the pool of people that we want to. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Representative
Barreto.
Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could you turn your name plate, please?
just Monday.
Yeah.
I was wondering, as far as the if a farmer then wants to sell his property to a first time farmer, and then he gets interest on that loan, and he carries a contract. Then is that money would be, or that income off the interest would be tax deductible. What does the farmer have to do to qualify as a lender? Are there any qualifications he has to fit into?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, you would have to consult with the Business Oregon to see how they would deal with an owner finance contract in that way. That's going to be handled in part by their rulemaking around it in terms of applying for this program specifically. It's not uncommon now to see owner-financed contracts where, you know, a landowner agrees to hold the, you know, carry the terms of the loan for the borrower. Specifically to this program, Business Oregon has an application process. There's fees associated with that. There's actually review by a bond counsel to ensure that rules are being met for the states being able to issue a bond. So that's sort of the check and balance in there to specifically ensure that if they're participating in this program, they're doing it the right way.
Thank you.
Thank you. So do you know if these lenders, when appropriate, are also regulated under the Department of Consumer and Business Services?
Chair Holvey, just a clarifying question. When you say these lenders, are you talking about Farm Credit Services, or are you talking about other lenders?
No, the other ones that could be in this, notwithstanding the land sale contracts of three and under per year.
Chair Holvey,
that are apparently envisioned in this amendment.
So Business Oregon already has rules in which they're defining what lenders are, and the challenge here is that it's narrowly defined in the original bill to be commercial lenders, essentially traditional banks. So you'd have to have them come up here to define a little bit more how they understand that. But there are actually rules in place, and we're trying to just expand the definition to include, you know, farm credit services. I doubt that individual lenders are necessarily, or individual farm owners are envisioned in the Department of Consumer and Business Services per se, but
that wasn't part of, right. Wasn't concerned about those individual farmers that are carrying paper when they make loans. It was others that are not described in the bill.
It's essentially giving Business Oregon the leeway to within state law make their own rules around to envision, to capture lenders that could be eligible under state rules, is my understanding.
Okay. Any other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3237? Or was that 3239?
3239.
Not seeing any, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3239 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3114. Jan, could you give us a brief description?
Mr. Chair, members, this measure allows injured workers to file workers' compensation claim within 1 year after the health benefit plan rejects their claim. Requires a health benefit plan to pay benefits in accordance with the terms, conditions, and benefits of the plan if the workers' compensation claim is denied. There is a -1 amendment that is before you, and instead of the 1 year period, it shortens it to 90 days that the injured worker can come back to workers' comp and file a claim after their health insurer has denied their claim.
Thank you. And before we call anybody up, committee, this is a bill that I brought forward as I was talking to some in the insurance industry and during some rulemaking last year, it became apparent there was some issues remaining about when a person comes to make a claim on their health insurance plan and the insurer or doctor feels that it's a worker comp issue, yet they had not filed a worker comp claim, that there was an ability for them to deny the insurance coverage and pending a worker comp decision. And so with that short description, we'll call up Jay Frazier, John Schiltz, and Jeanette Holman. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm John Schiltz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Thank you for having us here today. I'll give you a couple of pieces of background, which I think will provide good context for talking about the bill. Under the current law in workers' compensation, a worker or their dependent must immediately notify the employer of a work-related accident. In the case of injury or death, they're allowed to give this notice up to 90 days after the accident, with a few exceptions. Those exceptions would provide for notice up to a year if the employer had knowledge of the injury or death, the worker died within 180 days of the accident, or the worker or their beneficiaries can establish good cause for failing to provide notice of the claim within 90 days. In 2014, House Bill 4104 addressed the provision of interim medical benefits that the chair addressed a moment ago. These are medical services that are provided to a worker during a 60-day period where the workers' compensation insurer is determining whether to accept or deny a claim from the worker. If the worker has a health benefit plan, the bill, House Bill 4104, required provision of certain services by the health plan while the workers' compensation claim is being decided, subject to the health benefit plan's terms and policies. If the workers' compensation claim was accepted, the workers' compensation insurer or the self-insured employer would pay back the health plan and the worker for any payment they had made for the workers' conditions, subject to the workers' compensation fee schedule. If the workers' compensation insurer denied the claim, the health plan paid for the pre-authorized medical services that were provided to the worker, subject to their plan's terms and conditions. The health benefit plans were prohibited from excluding work-related injuries or diseases if the worker is covered by both workers' compensation and a health plan, and the worker had submitted a workers' compensation claim that had not yet been accepted or denied. House Bill 3114 addresses a situation where a worker has not filed a workers' compensation claim but has submitted a potentially work-related claim to their health benefit plan, and the plan rejects the claim as work-related. In that instance, the worker would have, under the current law, up to 1 year from the date of the health plan's denial to file a workers' compensation claim. In that instance, the worker, under the original version of House Bill 3114, would have 1 year to file their workers' compensation claim. Under the -1 amendments, that's been shortened to 90 days. The clock basically starts from the health benefit plan's action. If the worker files a workers' compensation claim and the workers' compensation insurer denies it, the workers' compensation insurer must notify the health benefit plan of the denial under this bill. Then the health benefit plan is required to process the claim for payment subject to its terms and conditions. The bill also clarifies that a worker's beneficiary, rather than a dependent, may provide the notice of an accident resulting in the worker's injury or death. Beneficiary includes a spouse and children. The proposed -1 amendment narrows the filing window from 1 year from the date the health plan rejects the claim to 90 days. The Management Labor Advisory Committee for Workers' Compensation heard this bill both on March 6th and March 20th. At their meeting last Friday, on the 20th, a question was raised about how long a health benefit plan has to process a claim in their system. The insurance statutes and rules require first that a clean claim statute apply. A clean claim is one where all the necessary information's available to process the request for benefits. The insurer shall pay or deny a claim not later than 30 days after the date the insurer receives the claim. If the health benefit plan requires additional information before the payment of a claim, within 30 days, the health benefit plan must notify the enrollee and the provider in writing and explain the additional information needed to process the claim. The insurer must pay, or excuse me, the health benefit plan must pay or deny that claim no more than 30 days after the insurer receives that additional information. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions now or after the rest of the panel has addressed you.
Let's have the rest of the panel go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jay Fraser, Safe Corporation. Appreciate Mr. Schultz's testimony this morning. I didn't have to go through and try to explain everything because I find it a little overwhelming sometimes myself. I think Safe Corporation has two major concerns. One, anytime you lengthen the time from which we know about a workers' compensation claim, it makes it more difficult for us to do our statutory investigation and to actually get the worker the benefits that they are entitled to, including time loss, return to work, and all of those things. So for us, as soon as we can know about a claim, it is much better for all parties. The other concern that we had was, I think, maybe it potentially addressed in the dash one, limiting the 90 days. We still have some concerns that we could potentially see claims out to a year, beyond a year, depending on how things were adjudicated by the health insurance company. The other concern that we have is that the proposed language uses claim for both workers' comp claim and for health claim. They are, mean very different things. Workers' comp, a claim is a very specific kind of moment in time around usually an injury, whereas in health insurance, a claim is every time a provider submits a bill. So the bill itself is a claim. So we really have, instead of a nice finite definition that we have in workers' comp, health insurance, it could be a rolling situation. So every time an individual goes to seek treatment with a physician or any other provider, that would be subsequently another claim. I believe it might be possible to address that in rule, but sometimes cleaning it up in statute might be helpful. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Ullman, go ahead.
Representative, or Chair Halvey, members of the committee, my name is Jeanette Holman. I'm a senior policy analyst for the insurance division, and I am only here to answer questions. So I don't have any prepared testimony.
Questions? So you say this bill's been talked about with MLAC. So has Ms. Frazier's concerns been discussed with MLAC? And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, the question was brought up last Friday at the MLAC meeting, and there wasn't a great deal of discussion about the question. We were asked whether or not we felt we could address the issue in rule, and we think that we can. Rulemaking is a public process as well, so I don't ever guarantee or promise what a rule is going to do. But, yes, I think we could address the issue in rulemaking.
Follow up. Is it cleaner just to do, isn't it perhaps cleaner to just do it in the legislation?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Kenemer, that would be a policy or a choice for you to make, I think. It's always great to have the statutes as clear as possible for administering the law, mm-hmm. from our perspective.
Mr. Chair, do you have plans to do that, or
time will tell.
Well, some of us could have something drafted if you're not, I guess, is my question.
Ms. Holman, I was curious about whether you see any way to solve this discrepancy between what a claim is in the insurance world as opposed to the worker comp world.
Chair Hulvey, members of the committee. I would lean towards rulemaking to do that, just because we have two different kinds of things going on, and that way we could address it and make it narrow. If you do it in the statute, then we're going to have to be really careful that we don't mess up the person who has several claims under their health benefit plan and say that they only have one or something like that. So my preference would be to do it in rule if we can, and I think we can.
Thank you.
Chair.
Representative Kinnamer.
I noticed Ms. Frazier's head nodding, but I didn't like it on the record and wondered if she had some response to the council's suggestion.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Kinnamer, members of the committee, I agree with Mr. Schultz. This is a policy decision for the legislature. I have worked with Ms. Holman in the past. I find her very capable. She's correct. We really are dealing with two different sets of statutes, the insurance and rules then. So it would be the insurance division rules and potentially the workers' compensation division rules. So it would be two sets of rulemaking. But I'm sure we can work together. We've done it in the past.
So as I know this issue was brought up and the bill drafted because of concerns from the insurance industry. Did they have any comments about this in the IMLAC proceeding? Since they're not signed up to testify.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would be no.
Interesting. Thank you. Seeing no further questions. Appreciate your comments this morning. And was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3114? Not seeing any. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3114. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2978.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure modifies the definition of a supervisory employee for the purposes of public employee collective bargaining law. And it specifies that police officers from a city of more than 325,000 who assign, transfer, or direct the work of other employees but does not have the authority to hire, fire, or impose economic discipline are not considered supervisory employees. There are no amendments before you.
Thank you. So could we have up Hank Kaplan, George Burke, and Dave Benson? Good morning, gentlemen. If you would identify yourself before giving your testimony.
Good morning. Chair Hulvey, members of the committee, my name is Hank Kaplan. George Burke is to my right, and Dave Benson is to my left. We are here to speak in favor of House Bill 2978. I am an attorney in Portland, and I've had the privilege of representing the Portland Police Commanding Officers Association for more than 25 years. Dave Benson was the president of the Portland Police Commanding Officers Association for many years, and George Burke is a current commander in the Portland Police Bureau. Until 2014, the PPCOA has always been comprised of lieutenants, captains, and commanders of the Portland Police Bureau. PPCOA had been a model of how collective bargaining best serves the interests of the city, its employees, and the public. For 25 years, lieutenants, captains, and commanders of PPCOA have been at the forefront of implementing community policing and changing the way that the police bureau serves the public. They've also worked collaboratively with the city to achieve labor peace. To give a little historical background, in 1995, a bill aimed at curbing the collective bargaining rights of teachers had the consequence, intended or unintended, of harming police officers. Perhaps recognizing that there was no good reason to apply the law to this union, the city left the PPCOA intact for the next 18 years. Perhaps the reason that none of Mayor Hale's predecessors tried to disband the PPCOA was that they took the time to understand the value and the role of the PPCOA in the police bureau. But in 2013, within months of taking office as Portland's new mayor, Charlie Hales announced his intent to disband the PPCOA even before the first budget cycle was complete. Was there a problem or a dysfunction that needed fixing? Mayor Hales publicly admitted that there wasn't. He offered no examples of any ways in which the PPCOA had interfered with the city's ability to manage the police bureau. Rather, he expressed his belief that as a matter of principle, those who perform managerial functions should not be members of a union. He issued statements about how we need a leadership team. And so he directed the city attorney's office to file what's called a unit clarification to disband the PPCOA. After protracted litigation, he did not succeed in disbanding the union, but he did manage to exclude most of the captains based almost entirely upon their ability to assign work to subordinates, something many private sector unionized lead workers do routinely. In seeking to decertify the PPCOA as a union, Mayor Hale sought to abrogate the right of PPCOA members to bargain collectively through the representatives of their own choosing, and for no discernible reason. This is Oregon. We are not Wisconsin. We do not engage in union busting for its own sake. We are a state that believes in its employees and in the right to speak with one collective voice. This is a state that's built on the backs of labor. Now, when similar legislation to House Bill 2978 came to this body in 2013, the Portland City Commissioners had no real justification to oppose it, so they made one up. They sent this body a letter dated March 18, 2013, that talked about a pending Department of Justice investigation on the use of force and said that this bill, quote, may result in members of a bargaining unit supervising the implementation of the very policies their union is currently suing to enjoin. But the PPCOA wasn't suing anybody. They were leading the implementation of these fundamental reforms, while the Portland Police Association, the rank-and-file union, filed that lawsuit. In other words, the city commissioners lied to the legislature.
Sir.
Please, you must be careful about calling people liars and impugning people's integrity. They may interpret facts differently, and, you know, you can have your own opinion about whether they lied, but in this public setting, you can disagree with their positions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. In any case, the legislature was misinformed as a result of a communication from the city. Now, when the city called for community policing, PPCOA members led the implementation. Whenever the Bureau asked for a new training regimen, these are the leaders that implement it. When the Department of Justice asked the Bureau to add programs to deal with mentally ill, the PPCOA got right to work on the details of that program. Serving as a police commanding officer requires skill, courage, and tact. They're constantly making decisions that may seem unpopular, but they are vital to public safety. Some of the best and brightest in these essential jobs are foregoing promotional opportunities because they fear being stripped of any protections that come with having a contract. They deserve basic protections and rights that workers in the public and private sector already enjoy through collective bargaining. Commanding officers in the union are free to make the tough calls in manners that they believe will best serve the public, knowing that in the final accounting, they will be able to defend their actions before an impartial arbitrator. Commanding officers without contract protection must balance the best solution against the safest solution, the one least likely to subject them to criticism and perhaps cost them their jobs, regardless of whether it's in the public interest. How does working without a safety net make a commanding officer freer to speak his or her mind? Finally, civil service does not provide anything near an adequate substitute for a union contract. These discipline cases are complicated. The civil service boards have neither the patience nor the expertise that an experienced labor arbitrator brings to the table. In any case, individuals who are not in a union can't afford the legal fees needed to fight these cases in front of any tribunal. We urge you to support House Bill 2978 and restore what was a productive status quo for 24 years.
Go ahead and introduce yourself if you'd like to provide testimony.
Good morning, Chair Holby, members of the committee. My name is Dave Benson. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2978. My testimony are my personal opinions today. I want to tell you that I had the good fortune from October of 84 until my retirement in July of 2011 of being a sworn member of the Portland Police Bureau. I served in a variety of assignments in the Bureau and rose through the ranks from officer and ultimately commanded two of the city's three precincts, the Tactical Operations Division and the Drugs and Vice Division. As part of my job, I served as a critical incident commander during high-risk situations requiring the deployment of the Special Emergency Reaction Team and have commanded officers during protests and public marches that sometimes small, sometimes large, numbering up to 25,000 or more participants and involving 200 or more police officers. In addition to these duties, from January of 95 until my retirement, I was a representative of the Commanding Officers Association. The majority of those years, I served as president. During those years and as lead negotiator, we won collective bargaining agreements. We processed grievances. During my tenure, the association was always able to engage in and resolve contract negotiations without ever having to request the assistance of a neutral third-party arbitrator. In addition, I was able to negotiate disciplinary matters with the city up to and including termination of association members, generally without having to resort to requesting help from a neutral third party. On the handful of occasions, for whatever reason, we did request some assistance, the association prevailed, usually in part or in whole. And in short, I think that demonstrates that the Commanding Officers Association was, and I believe still is, an organization that carefully evaluates the issues and works hard to resolve disagreements they have with the employer before resulting to the dispute resolution process, which I always viewed, and I think they always viewed, as an avenue of very, very last resort. And ultimately, I think what this all gave the city of Portland was a better trained and better educated group of commanding officers. The handful of command personnel who lead the men and women of the Portland Police Bureau work in an environment where expectations for performance are impossibly high, and where every decision is reviewed and scrutinized. The scrutiny and review, I would argue, is much more intense than levied on any other police command officer in the state of Oregon. These people risk discipline and even termination as a result of public outcry and not objective factors weighed against a reasonable standard. Lacking this protection, we should all worry that these commanding officers will opt to make defensible or popular decisions instead of the right decisions. Knowing that they have a bargaining unit to support them, commanding officers can make tough and correct decisions, and they all want to be held accountable for their actions. They just want to be fairly evaluated for the actions they make. I'll just close by saying the Portland Police Bureau is an outstanding law enforcement agency that is uniquely capable of learning and making changes to keep pace in a very dynamic, hypercharged social and political environment. Representation of these managers by a collective bargaining unit puts the organization, I believe, on a better footing to be held accountable, learn, and change. I appreciate your time, and I urge you to support House Bill 2978. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. I'm George Burke. I'm currently a commander with the Portland Police Bureau. Been in law enforcement for 25 years and have kind of a unique perspective on law enforcement as coming from a small agency in Washington County where I served for over 3.5 years and then ending up being hired by the Portland Police Bureau. And just like Dave Benson, was hired as a police officer and has risen through the ranks as being to be a command officer. One of my current roles as a commander is to be a crowd control incident commander, which is most of our work in working with protests. One of the concerns that I have as a commanding officer is not being represented. It has to do with decision making and decisions during highly quickly evolving incidents like crowd control or critical incidents, where the most popular decision or the safest decision for the commanding officer could be no decision or allowing things to continue on without stepping in and taking some sort of intervention. I'm not going to go through all the details of what that looks like, but I do have one particular incident I think that kind of brings things to light a little bit. Is in a recent incident within the city of Portland, we had a commanding officer who was observing, listening to a police pursuit that had initiated in the state of Washington. This was a violent offender who had tried to run people over with his car. And when the officer involved in the pursuit asked the commanding officer who was listening to the pursuit to give permission to use a technique to end the pursuit safely. That permission was given at risk to the commanding officer for making that decision. That outcomes could have been particularly negative, could have been different, could have looked much worse. It was effective. It worked. My concern is whether people in command would be willing to step up, take that responsibility, be available, be accessible, and answer the questions that need to be answered in a timely manner. We make our decisions based not on what is the most popular public opinion. That obviously is in the back of our mind, but we also have years of training experience and best practice that we try and operate behind. I think that's the best perspective for command people to operate under. I believe that it helps to create a safer community, and I believe that that gives better representation to the city of Portland as well as Portland Police Bureau. One of the other things that I'd like to add to is the fact that as a commanding officer in the organization in my current role, I can make recommendations toward discipline as we go through discipline processes. I'm able to pass on those recommendations, but even at the lowest levels of discipline, I am not able to impose any part of that discipline until it's signed off by the chief's office and ultimately from the mayor's office. So it is extremely important for us to recognize what our current role is, and therefore I support Senate Bill 2978.
Thank you. Questions to this panel? Representative Doherty.
Okay. This is kind of a comment question at the same time. Looking at the way that the language reads in this, and there have been a lot of unintended consequences over the past 20 years of Senate Bill 750, is that the definition of a supervisory employee, which currently apparently you guys are not, according to this, are they considering you Portland, you management or supervisory?
The captains in the bureau were excluded as as supervisory representative targeted.
Okay. A follow-up question?
Follow-up.
Okay. So with this, and I think this goes back to Commander Burke's question comment, is that according to the law, a supervisory employee has the authority in the interest of the employer to hire, transfer, suspend, lay off, recall, promote, discharge, assign, reward, or discipline other employees, and you must use your independent judgment. That's the way that the supervisory law reads, or the definition. The definition of managerial employee says one who possesses authority to formulate and carry out management decisions or who represents management's interest by taking or effectively recommending discretionary actions. Okay, this is my comment. As a command officer, I would have trouble delineating between the two. In other words, if I'm excluded and make my own independent judgment, then I could get in trouble and not have any recourse. And so how difficult is it for you gentlemen and ladies to make decisions based upon the ambiguous language that the law reads when if you're considered a supervisor and out of the bargaining unit, you have no rights?
Chairholder.
That makes sense?
Chair Holding, Representative Daugherty, I'm not sure that this quite directly answers the question, but perhaps it would be clarifying to understand that the managerial exception only applies to state employees. The supervisory exception is what applies to
So even with the supervisory, if I have a follow-up, even with a supervisory, you've got all of these alleged duties, and that basically you're supposed to use your independent judgment, but if you're the police chief's office does not agree with your independent judgment, you can get into trouble without any union representation. Is that correct?
As I yes, as I understand, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Representative Evans.
I just wanted to clarify over here. Hi. Just want to clarify. So as it stands right now, you do not have the authority to fire, right? The chief has to sign off on it, because earlier I thought I heard that the other commander had been involved in termination of somebody. I just want to know what that line is.
Well, I could answer part of that. I was a representative. I was president of the association, and I negotiated with the city the termination of a commanding officer. So it wasn't that I was making the decision. I was an association representative. I negotiated with the city that ultimately led to the chief and the mayor making the decision to terminate the employee. I had nothing to do with the decision to terminate.
Okay, so it's not your role as a commander that led. No. Okay, all right, thank you. That's fine.
Other questions? Representative Nose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if the panel, for those of us that aren't from a law enforcement background or even have a military background, if you could just delineate the chief on down to the rank and file officer, what the levels of command are, I think it would be illustrative.
Chair Holby, Representative Nose. In the Portland Police Bureau, the chief and the assistant chiefs are not members of any bargaining unit and never were. The next level down would be the commanding officers and the captains who were represented by the Portland Police Commanding Officers Association for 24 years, but have not been since the conclusion of the unit clarification litigation.
Thank you.
Follow up. How many assistant chiefs are there?
Three.
How many? Follow up. How many commanding? I can't tell if you use commander and captain interchangeably, so I'm confused about that. Is a commander a separate rank?
Chair Holby, Representative Nose. Technically, all of the ranks above lieutenant are in the civil service classification of captain, but the commander rank is a special premium pay in the classification of captain and has generally somewhat broader authority than the captains.
More follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
How many, can you tell me, so there's a chief, there's three assistant chiefs, how many captains, commanders are there roughly?
Chair Holder, Representative Nose, I think it's about a dozen that we're talking about that were excluded as a result of the unit clarification.
Thank you.
Representative Barreto, did you have a question?
No.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess so. It's a dozen employees that we're looking at here that are captains, then it sounds like. So I guess my question is, where would you have that cutoff line? Another city grows up to this level, because we have your counties, lots of other cities that could grow into this level. And captains, I mean, as a captain, I have two captains sitting right here, I'm assuming in front of me. You don't have the ability to actually, I mean, have the final say on firing somebody, but if you walk into the office to the chief and say, or an assistant chief, because I'm sure a captain answers the assistant chief that goes to chief, because you guys are large, and this is the way most large plants even work outside with the union, is you have supervisors, and it kind of goes down. The way I looked at it, when I'm a supervisor, I work for the plant manager. So, and then I could have another maintenance manager, production manager in between us. It would be your assistant chief. If you go to your assistant chief and say, so-and-so's out there doing this, I suspect they're doing this and they're doing it wrong and it's harmful, and we need to look at removing them or doing something to them, would not that assistant chief take that seriously if you walked to him and said that to them?
Chair Holby, Representative Widener.
Actually, this is for the captains, not the attorney.
Okay. Chair Holby, Representative Widener, I would say that we have been able to make recommendations, but in no way are we able to make any final decisions as far as any discipline at any level in the police bureau. There's a process that has to be gone through, which includes a complete review, an investigation. It's not as simple as just going and making a recommendation and having that recommendation followed through.
Follow up. My question is, you go to that assistant chief and you tell him that this person is not doing the job or something's going on. I mean, you probably don't write them up, I would assume. That would go to the assistant chief. But when you go to the assistant chief and you tell him that, or go to the chief and talk to him about someone below you, someone on your team, is he not going to follow up on that action because it came from you?
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, I can't say that I've been in that position. It's causing me to create some supposition at this point. I have not had that opportunity or been put in that position when it comes to a sworn member being involved in a termination process. I have asked to have people transferred and have found that to be difficult at best. I've made recommendations to move people in the organization and have been told that we couldn't. So in order to answer your question, I don't believe that I'm able to give truly effective recommendations regarding transfers, let alone termination.
If I may follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because there has to be structure and organization through. And it's what I'm thinking, if we put you in collective bargaining, now you're taking an oath to your union brotherhood at that point. So how can you supervise somebody or go to them and say this is going on when you've taken an oath to basically protect your union brother who you're supposed to be supervising? That's kind of where I'm going here.
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, maybe I can help, because I was a union representative and a commanding officer 17 years, and it is an interesting relationship, but I will tell you that anyone in the organization, whether they're a represented employee or not, can initiate a complaint about misconduct. And I have, as a commanding officer, initiated complaints about misconduct about fellow union members, if you will. And I did that as the president of the association. And we've had members of the police association make complaints about other police officers. So it is a little bit apples and oranges. And I think folks do a pretty good job of keeping the two separated. You have a duty as a police officer and, or in my case, a commanding officer. And I took those jobs very seriously. And then you have the duties as a commanding officer, part of a labor organization, which just simply helped ensure that people got fair and equitable treatment. Does that help?
That's a little. I mean, because I've actually been.
Representative Noss, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do not disagree at all that you all work in a very highly political and politicized environment. It's a big city. Everything that the police do is covered and scrutinized. It makes the news, and so they're in a very, I think, unique situation. And I'll freely admit, I don't monitor police news from Eugene and Salem and other cities in this community, but I know that anything that law enforcement in the city of Portland does is highly looked at. I feel like you've answered questions I had about how the hiring and firing situation goes. I'm wondering if you could address the city council and the mayor come to a deliberative decision about a direction that policing needs to go in the community. And they've deliberated that, they've decided, and if the mayor or the police chief now gives you a policy directive that maybe your association disagrees with or had questions about, but you, at the end of the day, didn't prevail in that policy deliberation. The community made a different choice. How do you handle that tension?
Chair Holby, Representative Noss. There's a long established rule in labor law that says work now, grieve later. When an employer issues a directive, it is the job of the employee, in whatever union they are in, to carry out the directives of the employer. And if they feel that the directives raise mandatory subjects of implicate mandatory subjects of bargaining, well, then the union can ask to bargain over if it's a workload issue or what have you. But it has never been an issue of hesitancy on the part of the PPCOA to carry out the policy directives of the city of Portland. The PPCOA has always led the Bureau in not only carrying them out, but really positively putting into place the cultural changes that needed to be made in order to carry out those directives.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up? Just one.
Follow up.
So I hear you about workload. I think that's about having the resources and the tools to do the job that you've been asked to do. My question is, again, I think you answered it. So if the community, through its elected leaders, says we're going to go direction on profiling or on community policing, the union, the members in those roles are going to implement that directive. That's what I'm trying to get at. Not about a discussion about workload or do we have the resources, you know, or even termination or hiring, firing, but like, okay, this is the policy direction we're going. We didn't always agree with it or we had concerns, but we're going to go forward.
Chair Holby, Representative Nose, having been there for 17 years, been there, and we implement the policy. If there are issues and change of working conditions or what have you, those are generally discussions that are held quietly, frankly, and most times we resolve them. And if we can't resolve them, we winnow it down to a specific issue or two. But I can tell you, over 17 years, if the mayor or the chief says we're going to do A, the commanding officer association carry that flag. Mm-hmm. It was always my job. We were going to carry that flag, and we were going to support the mayor and the chief. And if there, like I said, if there were issues, we generally work them out with the city.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Up Thank next. You. Dan Thinnell and Michael Savaggio. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Savaggio, here representing the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. As we've heard, under Oregon's Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act, many law enforcement officers already have the right to join a bargaining unit to bargain wages, hours, and working conditions. It's similar to the rights enjoyed by many other professions, both in the public and private sectors. However, as we've heard, under the current definition of supervisory employee, we have many officers excluded from such bargaining rights, even though they lack the authorities that we've been discussing. Even when officers such as sergeants, lieutenants, and captains are essentially carrying out management decisions, the overly broad definition unfairly bars them from enjoying the same organizing and bargaining rights as their fellow officers. And I want to emphasize the carrying out of management decisions. I personally work in the private sector. There's a lot of discretion that I have, that my supervisors have, regarding discipline, regarding hiring, firing. But in a police department, in a law enforcement agency, when management constructs policies around that type of thing, there's often not a lot of discretion. So if a commanding officer or sergeant wants to say, here's a recommendation up to management, that's not something that just kind of popped into their head willy-nilly. That's stemming from a very precise management policy. So this creates a situation where officers, as we've heard, may forego promotions to positions with less job security, whether there are minimal or no job protections. It also means that many officers are faced with a job that lacks organizing protections of Oregon's Collective Bargaining Act, but also lacks the various authorities and rights that are ordinarily part and parcel to those positions. We feel that Oregonians deserve their law enforcement agencies to be staffed effectively, prudently, and make decisions that are not subject to other considerations stemming from arbitrary workforce divisions. So the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs wants to express its support of House Bill 2978, which corrects these oversights and brings certain law enforcement officers the option, and I want to stress that it's an option, not a mandate, to join a bargaining unit. The bill also makes strides to standardize the treatment of police officers in this regard to that of other public safety officers, such as firefighters. We'll also be asking the committee to consider amendments that have been printed, the Dash 1 amendments. These are similar to the introduced bill, except they do not include a population threshold. They apply to law enforcement officers generally, not merely municipal law enforcement officers. The reason here is that because of the regardless of the size of a community, law enforcement officers are entrusted by all of us to put their safety and lives on the line every day to protect that community. Surely we can entrust them with the option to avail themselves of common employment and bargaining rights. Thank you.
Good morning. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Dan Tinnell. I'm an attorney in Tigard. I've been asked to come on behalf of five police organizations to support the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2978. I've been given authority by groups of sergeants and other organizations to identify their efforts to become organized and have collective bargaining rights. The organizations that have asked me to come and speak to you today are the Fraternal Order of Police Oregon Lodge, which is over 400 members in the state of Oregon and is part of a national organization of over 300,000 police officers. I've been also asked to come in support of this bill and to urge you to look at the Dash 1 Amendment by the Hillsborough Police Sergeants Association, which is currently in the middle of an Employment Relations Board hearing regarding whether they qualify under the current definition of supervisor to become a collective bargaining organization. Additionally, my office was retained by the Washington County Sergeants Association to file a petition so the sergeants in the Washington County Patrol and Investigations Division can have a hearing about whether they qualify as supervisors and have the right to be a collective bargaining organization. I represent the Tualatin Police Sergeants Association, which in the middle of April is going to have a hearing with the city. And finally, I'm here on behalf of a West Lynn police sergeant who led the effort to attempt to have a collective bargaining organization in his agency. Cities are fighting this aggressively. The management, the chiefs, want to maintain the control over the sergeants. Sergeants are currently, in many of these organizations, at-will employees. They are line field leaders who are out patrolling, responding to critical incidents, potentially involved in shootings. They have no rights at all. They can be fired in some circumstances at the whim of the chief. That is inconsistent with Oregon law, which presumes public employees have the right to have representation. And that is what they are asking for. I'd like this committee to consider four issues that currently exist and why this bill, with the elimination of the population restriction, should be strongly considered by you and supported by you. Most decision making in smaller agencies, and I understand and I commiserate with those commanding officers in the city of Portland that were excluded in the City of Portland versus Portland Police Commanding Officers Association ERB decision that came down last year. But in smaller police agencies and in larger county organizations, the decision making is incredibly centralized. And while a sergeant or even a lieutenant in certain circumstances may sign a letter that involves discipline, they are not the ones with the actual authority to make that discipline. They are being directed what to do. Additionally, and I touched on this, it is our belief that frontline police field leaders should not be at-will employees. They should have the same rights as the officers that they perform any of the same functions as. I also would like the council to understand, and you may have questions about this, there's a difference between implementation and actual authority. There's a difference between who signs a letter or who talks to an officer about discipline and who is actually making that decision. In the proceedings that I've been involved with in the last several months regarding whether sergeants in Hillsborough and Tualatin should become organized and have collective bargaining rights so they can discuss whether their wages are equivalent to those underneath them or slightly better, whether they should have protection and representation if their jobs are at risk, if they should be able to have representation if they, God forbid, get in a shooting or responding or at a police shooting. And what is actually occurring is they're being told what to do. I have an email from a lieutenant in the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office that I would like to read to you because it illustrates the point that I'm trying to make. I do not have permission to identify this person, and I think the committee can understand why that is. As a 19-year police veteran and a manager in a police agency in a population over 325,000 people, I have some thoughts on the amendment being considered. The amendment includes personnel able to impose economic discipline. As a manager, I have been recently granted the authority to impose suspension as part of my job duties, although in practice, I do not have the authority to make the final decision, only the initial recommendation and then implementation. I would support the removal of the population limitation in the amendment language and encourage the committee to also encourage language or the concept about final authority to impose. And although I've been granted authority to impose, I do not have the final authority. It must be approved by a higher authority and may be overturned. And in my experience in looking at situations in both the Tualatin and the Hillsborough proceedings that are currently going on in the Employment Relations Board, those recommendations and those decisions are many times overturned by the final authorities, and those are the people that are ultimately making the decisions. I would ask you to strongly consider the Dash 1 Amendment to House Bill 2978 and give people the right to have the protections that they should have. And I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions of this panel? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's my question, because I'm trying to tell you right now I'm going to have troubles getting there on this, because I know the importance of having supervisors and being able to work for the chief and the mayor and everything, and that's who you answer to in those roles and going out. But if it sounds like it's about protection and maybe benefits is the big thing that we're looking at here that we need to address. So it sounds like maybe there's something else we need to look at when collective bargaining happens that we look out for commanders to where they're not paid less than what a frontline employee would be or something like that. Am I wrong on that, since you're representing all these different organizations?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, I think the structure of agencies is always very fact specific, and to the extent I understand your question, it has to do with what are the concerns of sergeants or potentially lieutenants that are coming forward to attempt to be recognized outside of the city of Portland. That is also fact-specific. It is going to depend on what those chiefs and sheriffs have decided to give those people. Let me give you an example. As many of you know, this weekend there was a homicide in Marion County. And in finding out about this bill on Saturday afternoon and then the Dash 1 amendments yesterday afternoon, I spent a great deal of time on the phone and email with interested people. One of the there is a sergeant from Marion County who is very interested in having their sergeants be organized. He responded to a shooting this weekend, and he is not entitled to overtime. I don't know how he is compensated. He wanted to come and speak today, but he could not make it because he was on duty. So that is a very agency-specific issue. Is it pay in one agency, or is it really the protection of being an at-will employee when you're out on the road responding to calls with line officers? And so it's going to depend on the relationship that exists with those sergeants, because really this I don't want to diminish lieutenants in certain agencies, and I certainly do not want to diminish the efforts of the commanding officers in Portland that were excluded by the decision, but it depends on how those people are treated, and it depends on what they have. It's different in every organization. In the two organizations that I'm currently representing before the Employment Relations Board, you have sergeants that are literally working the road and responding to calls and supervising calls. They are at will. They're essentially at-will employees. They have no rights at all unless granted to them by city policy or the agency's policies. In each of these organizations, they answer to at least one lieutenant in Tualatin or multiple lieutenants in Hillsboro, who answer to commanders or captains, and then there may be a chief or a deputy chief. There are multiple layers of quote management or higher supervisors over these people that these decisions and recommendations filter through. So that's the best that I can answer that question, and I hope that I've given you some helpful information.
Representative Evans.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I just want to clarify again. I'm hearing the term at will.
Correct.
When I think of at will, it's I walk in and today, Bob, you have a blue shirt, so you're gone. When I was mayor, that was not the case with our supervisory folks. There was a process that we could be sued if they were let go for the wrong reason. So please explain the at-willness, if you can.
In the two cities that I'm speaking of, their sergeants are at will.
There's no policy whatsoever.
They can be fired for anything. I'm sorry, Chair Holvey, Representative Evans. They have certain city policies that allow the decision to be passed up to the city manager, but they don't have legal rights in their job. They don't have a property interest in their job. That's how I'm using the term at will. They don't have a property interest, so that if that property interest is deprived of them without due process, they can go to court and have a court review whether due process has been followed. They don't have that option. And again, it kind of goes back to what Representative Widener was talking about. It is very individualized depending on what agency, city, or sheriff's office you're discussing, because it depends on the policies of the county or the city.
Okay. Thank you. And just one short question. So from listening to you, you're describing that these captains don't have the effective or don't have the authority to effectively recommend to hire, discharge, or impose economic discipline because they don't have the final say-so when oftentimes their recommendations are not taken. Is that, in a nutshell, correct, what you're saying?
Chair Holvey, yes, that's what I'm saying. Specifically with Hillsboro and Tualatin, they're told what to do. Now, they may investigate facts. They may look into, for instance, an internal affairs investigation, and they may make factual findings. But the decision of what occurs is ultimately in the administration.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Chair Holvey, I also want to note to build on that explanation just a little bit, that in terms of even the recommendations of discipline and other actions, those are all stemming from policies that are explicitly and almost entirely developed by the management of the agency. So we're not just talking about a sergeant or a captain having to make a recommendation for a particular action, but also that recommendation needs to just be carrying out policy that someone else has developed. And that's a significant part of the description that we're offering in this bill.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Up next, I'd like Martha Pellegrino, Lori Kraut, and Scott Winkles.
Good morning.
Good morning. Chair, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Certainly. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, for the record, Martha Pellegrino representing the City of Portland. With me today is Lori Kraut from the Portland City Attorney's Office. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you this morning. Let me begin by saying that the City of Portland is extremely proud of the men and women who put their lives on the line every day at every single level of the Portland Police Bureau. Our community is stronger and safer because of their deep commitment to service. However, I am here today to express some concerns about House Bill 2978. This bill modifies the definition of supervisor for the purpose of determining who is eligible for participating in a bargaining unit. This bill is aimed only at changing this definition for the City of Portland and no other jurisdictions in the state of Oregon. As many of you know, there is a great deal of important work happening in the Portland Police Bureau to increase accountability and transparency and to strengthen relationships and deepen trust in the community. These are priorities that are shared by the leadership of the city and the men and women in the Portland Police Bureau. I'd like to provide just some brief historical context to put this legislation in perspective. In May of 2013, the City of Portland filed a unit clarification petition with the Employment Relations Board seeking to clarify whether the highest-ranking officers in the Portland Police Bureau should be in a bargaining unit. Last year, the IRB issued a ruling that did not completely satisfy either the city or the PPCOA. And as you've heard, the ruling indicated that all lieutenants were included in the bargaining unit, all commanders were excluded in the bargaining unit, and some captains, there was a mixed result. Some captains were in and some captains were out, depending on their role. Both parties agreed that having a few captains in and a few captains out would have been unworkable and difficult to administer. So instead of appealing the IRB decision, both sides came together in good faith and negotiated a settlement agreement. In the settlement agreement, the city retained the majority of the salary and benefit provisions for the captain and commanders that had been in their collective bargaining agreement. PPCOA agreed to remove the remaining captains from the unit. Allow me to note that Mr. Kaplan is actually a signatory to this agreement. So this means that currently there are a small but workable group of managers in the Portland Police Bureau who are able to provide effective oversight and who are responsible for overseeing the critical efforts underway to increase transparency and accountability in how the Portland Police serve the public. To illustrate the current structure of the Portland Police Bureau and to address a prior question posed by Representative Noth, I handed out a chart that demonstrates how the ranks are in Portland as compared to other jurisdictions statewide. On the far left are the different ranks and numbers of certified personnel in the Portland Police Bureau. And you can see that the positions that are shaded in blue are the officers and the sergeants that belong to the Portland Police Association. In orange are the lieutenants who are currently part of the Portland Police Commanding Officers Association. And at issue in this bill are the positions shaded in yellow, which represent 22 out of 895 positions in the Portland Police Bureau. That includes assistant chiefs who oversee entire branches of the Portland Police Bureau, except for those who serve as confidential employees, commanders who oversee entire precincts, and captains who oversee entire divisions. By way of comparison to the rest of the state, the police and command staff in Portland enjoy greater employment protections than other jurisdictions around the state under current law. And let me just conclude by saying that there are discussions underway between city leadership and the PPCOA to address outstanding issues related to their settlement agreement. And we ask that this committee allow the city and PPCOA to achieve resolution locally on these issues. So thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to take questions now or after we've concluded this panel. Thank you.
We'll wait for the panel to conclude before asking questions. Go ahead, either of you, just please introduce yourself.
Why don't you go ahead, sir?
Vice Chair Barton, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. While the League typically does not only engages on issues of statewide concern, we are very concerned about the precedential nature of this bill coming straight on the heels of an herb decision. And I want to sort of walk you through the three-part test that the herb used to determine as to whether or not the employees in question today in the Portland bill, I'll get to the amendment in a minute, are in fact supervisors. And the first test they have is, does the employee have the authority to take action or effectively recommend action be taken in any of the 12 listed supervisory activities, hire, fire, transfer, discipline, reward, etc.? Does the exercise of that authority require the use of independent judgment? Does the employee hold the authority in the interest of management? The answer to all three of these questions must be yes in order for the ERB to decide if these employees are in fact. And there's quite a bit of case law, both within the ERB and with the national through the National Labor Relations Board. First off, and I'd also want to illuminate a little bit on this effectively recommend. There seem to be some questions. In an AFSCME case in front of the ERB ruled that the sort of illuminated what they mean by effectively recommend, and that means that that employee's position, that employee's recommendation, must be given due credence. It must be followed more often than not. In the case of the Portland command staff, there was a resounding yes. So I must ask respectfully, what is the public's interest in defining these employees as non-supervisory if they have these facts? We have a finding of fact that these people can do these things. What is the public's interest in redefining them as non-supervisory employees? We have the city of Portland is unique in the state in that it has a DOJ settlement it must implement. It must have the flexibility to address, to make these assignments, to make changes in the agency. In order to meet with that compliance. If we have resistance, is this something that we should be resolving at a bargaining table? We believe not. Additionally, I want to talk about a little bit about some comments made about the importance of the decisions made by these officers, the stress involved, the importance of these decisions. If you look at the chart that Portland handed out, Portland's the only city that had this command staff unions arrangement. The same decisions are being made in Eugene and in Tigard and in Marion County, Washington County, and Gresham. Other jurisdictions can do this. Lieutenants, commanders, senior officers are making these decisions, are doing it effectively. And lastly, I would say, as to the status of the Tigard and Tualatin fire at Will sergeants, I stepped out of the room briefly to make a call to that city manager, and I will advise the committee in writing as to the nature of the fire at Will status and comment that was made when we have that adequately clarified. But we'd urge due caution in proceeding forward with this bill. We have a process that works. We have an ERB ruling. An effective ERB ruling that determined that these people could meet the statutory functions. With that, I will conclude my testimony.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Lori Kraut from the City Attorney's Office. Two issues that I heard from the other testimony that I'd like to just address very quickly. Representative Evans, you questioned the concept of at-will employment. I just want to make clear that the lieutenants and captains at the Portland Police Bureau have civil service. They are not at will. We have a civil service board. The city is required, if it takes discipline, suspensions without pay, demotions, discharge, that it must do so for cause. And our civil service board interprets cause under the same standards as an arbitrator would use for just cause. The second point I'd like to make is, in the city of Portland, we have a very comprehensive discipline review process. And it has been approved by the Department of Justice under our settlement agreement. And let me just explain to you a little bit about how that process works. If a member is a member's performance is under scrutiny, and so we go through an investigation. They call them RU managers, will make findings or delegate that to a subordinate. We have lieutenants making those findings, and then it goes up the chain of command for review. If the recommendation is for suspension without pay, demotion, discipline, then it must go to this review level proceeding. And there are five members who vote on it. This is an advisory body to the chief of police. And the five voting members include the RU manager, the assistant chief of that branch, the Office of Independent Police Review, a member of IPR. We have a citizen member and a peer member, and they collectively determine whether the investigation, there was a finding that it violated policy, and then they make the recommendation to the chief of police. So that is our process, and we involve our community, and we have a lot of oversight, and that is why, although the RU manager, which could be a captain or a commander, has a vote in this, it is not just left to their single decision. And I hope that provides some clarification.
Representative Nose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I forgot your name to the city attorney. Can you tell me, under the civil service process that you use, you said you use the just cause standard. Does that also include the ability for that officer to access an arbitrator if the findings, you know, go against that officer?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Not seeing any at this time. Thank you very much for your testimony. With that, is there anybody else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2978? Not seeing any out. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2978. Gee, what's next? And I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2005. Committee, I scheduled this for a work session so the committee would have time to go over the Dash 1 amendments. Not my intent to move any amendments or bills today. This is purely a chance for us to review what a work group has come up with. The work group included myself and Senator Dimbrough, Representative Kinnamer, Senator Thatcher, representatives from AOI, the Restaurant Association and OBA, as well as SEIU and Family Forward and the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And so I'm going to have Jan sort of walk through what the Dash 1 amendment is. I know there are a multitude, and I say that a multitude of other amendments that will be coming that will probably be addressing this Dash 1 amendment. So if you look at that Dash 1 amendment sort of as the as a base of further discussions that we'll have on Wednesday on other amendments as well. I thought this would be a useful time for us to look at this bill, very important piece of legislation before us. So, Jan, could you give us a brief description?
I will. We have a couple of paper copies of the amendment if somebody didn't have theirs with them and want it. So this is a Dash 1 amendment, and I'm just going to go by section by section and highlight the major differences from the original bill. In Section 1, the definition of employee has changed. It's using the definition that you would find in the wage and hour chapter. And excluded are family members, independent contractors, and interns. The definition of a family member is in Section 1, and it is much narrower than what was in the original bill. It is now the definition of a family member that you would find under OFLA. In Section 3, the employer size has changed. So paid sick leave is required for employers that have six or more employees. For those that are smaller, they would have to provide unpaid protective leave for their employees. In Section 3 also, the annual benefit for paid sick leave or unpaid leave as well is a maximum of 40 hours that they can earn and use, and they can accumulate up to 80 hours if the employer wants to have that be their employee policy. Also, Section 3, they can carry over 40 hours to the next year. And again, the employer can cap that at 80 hours, so they could never accrue more than 80 hours. The accrual rate is now stated as being at least 1 hour of leave for every 30 hours work. Shift trading in Section 3 changed so that it's by mutual consent of the employee and the employer, and it took out the requirement that the shift trade had to occur in the current or the next pay period. Section 3 and 5, the waiting period, indicates that if there's a break in service and the person returns within 180 days, the waiting clock stops, and when they return, it picks up right where they had left off to reach that 90 days. And Section 3 also is the right of return. Actually, I think that is no change. It's still the 180 days that they can return and pick up where they left off. Section 4 is dealing with an employer's existing paid time off policy. The PTO has to provide at least 40 hours of leave to meet the standard. And employers that offer 40 hours of sick leave at the beginning of each year have been determined to meet the standard, and BOLI will advise employers as to whether their PTO meets the standard. Section 7 is the minimum leave increment, minor change. It's now 1 hour, so they deleted that it would be 1 hour or the smallest increment that the payroll system used. And the employee will make a good faith effort to take leave when it's least disruptive to the business. Section 9 is medical verification. It adds that the employer can require verification if there's a pattern of abuse. That's new to this amendment. And that the employer is responsible to the employee for costs to get the medical verification, and that could include lost wages. Section 10 is record keeping, took out requirement that they keep and maintain records, but maintain that they still have to provide the employee with notice on a quarterly basis of how much leave they have. Section 13, this is the collective bargaining exemption. It's changed to read that it exempts employees whose terms and conditions of employment are covered by a multi-employer collective bargaining agreement, and that they're employed through a hiring hall, and their benefits are delivered through a multi-employer trust. So it got away from specifically naming the construction and trades industry and the stagehands and longshoremen. Section 13 also specifies that the Home Care Commission is going to be directed to establish a paid sick time policy for the consumer-employed home care workers. That was not in the original bill. Section 16 is the statewide preemption. So local governments are preempted from implementing their own sick leave ordinances. Sections 14, 15, and 19 deal with enforcement. And I'll point out that an employee bringing a private right of action would be, could seek injunctive relief, back pay, costs, and attorney fees, but there would be no damages allowed. Section 20 adds a grace period. So the law would become effective January 2016, but not until January 2017 could there be any penalties assessed except for retaliation. I think those are the highlights.
Thank you. Committee, I do note that if you do have specific questions right now about the dash ones, that we do have legislative counsel in the room that could give you perhaps an answer to those that if we can't.
Mr. Chair, maybe just a comment and
stuff. Representative Kinnemer.
I want to thank you for putting together the work group. I would grant that it's a better product than the bill. But Senator Thatcher and I, who sat on it, do not support the amendment, and I just want to clarify that for the record, and have considerable concerns about the bill,
fair to note.
I guess would see it as would see it as anti-business, and have grave concerns about its impact.
Yeah. Thank you. I will note that the work group was not intended to be a consensus outcome. No. Very difficult to get a consensus on such a topic, and you're certainly welcome to your opinion. I would say my opinion is it seems to be pro-worker. So, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to verify, because I do have amendments coming that are pro-worker and pro-employer. So I think they address very major concerns, and I just want to make sure we're going to have a chance to have those amendments before we move this bill forward, so we have a chance to maybe amend them into it.
I can't foretell when the amendments will be done or not. This bill's been around for quite some time, and I do note that the Legislative Council got an extraordinary amount of requests for amendments, so the priority of which those requests get met is something I don't have control over.
I think, Mr. Chair, we need to at least allow some time, because I had put mine in probably 3 weeks ago, and they're still working on getting them done. So, I mean,
well, let's hope they get done, Representative Widener. We'll certainly make our efforts, and I'll encourage Legislative Council to work harder.
I thought you were nice to workers. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
That was trying to be a little facetious.
Yes, but, you were. I had to call you on that a little bit, Mr. Chair. If I could just one more comment about that. Yes, and I appreciate it. Poor Charlie down there in Legislative Council has got to be overwhelmed. But I would say, you know, when I guess as far as I can tell, there are about 30 different amendments. I've been working to see if there is some way we can have a less scattered approach and make it a little simpler. But it is, when there is so much disagreement and we're at such distances, it's hard to do.
Certainly.
And I appreciate that. I think everyone is being very charitable and professional, and that is helpful too.
you. Anything specifically about the Dash 1 amendment as opposed to our opinions of process and...
I think Charlie and Gail are wonderful.
Pro-business. Yeah. So I'm sure we all do. So not seeing any committee, I do recommend that you do take a close look at these Dash 1s to help make sense out of the other amendments that will be coming. And hopefully we do get a chance to review on Wednesday. So with that, yes, we will. So we will be carrying over the work session to Wednesday for House Bill 2005.
I think that's a good idea. And
any other items on our agenda? With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2005 and adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.
I think more than one.
Are you?
I think more than one.
Are you?
Business and Labor.